The natural world is full of wonder and beauty, but it's also full of danger, according to our guest this hour, an evolutionary biologist who has studied the dark side of nature. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm looking forward to this hour. At least I think I'm looking forward to this hour. I know it's going to be informative and interesting, but it's also going to be creepy and icky as we learn about bedbugs and maggots and bats and mice and other creatures that can be dangerous. Don't turn off the radio, though, because what you don't know could hurt you. Plus, you'll find out why these creepy crawlies do what they do, and you'll have some gross stories that you can share at your next cocktail party. Have you a vote for the most hideously horrible animal or insect? You can let us know, as well as your questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guest. Dan Riskin is an evolutionary biologist. He is host of Animal Planet's Monsters Inside Me and author of Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, a lively tour through the dark side of the natural world. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me.
So where did you get the idea to write this book?
Well, I'm a bat biologist. That's my background. I love bats. I'm passionate about them. I studied vampire bats for my PhD. And there's just something about creatures that are misunderstood that draws me, and I want to learn more about them. And you know, what typically happens is that people try to sort of say, well, you know, bats are nice because they eat a lot of insects. And bats are nice because if part of the rainforest has been cut down, the way that the trees can get back into that clear cut is that a bat has eaten fruit and it poops out seeds when it's flying over that clear cut, and that's how the trees get back. And those things are all true. But I think that trying to convince people that bats are really nice is not necessarily the way that you can show the best side of bats. I studied vampire bats, and vampire bats are very cool for a lot of reasons, but they do drink blood, and they sneak up on a sleeping cow. They shave the fur where they want to bite. They have heat sensors on their nose leaf that they can use to detect the temperature so they can find a place where blood comes close to the skin. They make a little bite, and they drink blood. They do nothing. They don't eat anything except for blood. They've become giant mosquito-like parasites. And it's when you start going after those angles that I think the really interesting stuff starts to come out. And what I keep telling people is that, you know, everybody loves nature, but a lot of people miss out on the best parts because they're always looking for these happy stories where everybody's cuddling and really deep down a killer whale wants to be your friend. But the truth is that animals do terrible things to one another. And it's only when you look at that vulgar, disgusting, rude side of nature that you start to see the absolutely most beautiful parts. And so that's what I've done with my book, is to really explore the things you should not talk about at the dinner table and try to make those as accessible as possible so people can see the parts of nature that I think are its most beautiful.
That's wonderful. And I have to admit, though, I really did get a case of the creepy crawlies right away when you talked about an experience you had in Belize, because I just returned from Belize.
Oh.
And it was lovely, except for the cockroaches and the tarantulas. I thought it was just just great. But you tell us about your encounter with the bot fly.
Yeah, no, I went to Belize to study bats, and Belize is beautiful. You're right, there are cockroaches and tarantulas. I think those are kind of fun parts of, mm-hmm. of Belize. I remember setting up nets in the rainforest at night and finding tarantulas and just being marveling at the fact that I was meeting a tarantula in the wild. Most people only ever mm-hmm. see tarantulas, you know, when in a zoo or something like that. And here I was face to face with this thing, and I had all kinds of experiences, monkeys throwing their own poop at me to try to get me to leave them alone. Or vampire bats that we caught in our nets. I mean, it was a really fun trip, and I had a great time seeing nature. But then I got home, just like you've just gotten home, and I had mosquito bites, much the same as I assume you do right now. And one of those mosquito bites on the top of my head started growing. And I knew immediately that this was probably a bot fly. And so what a bot fly does is the bot fly catches a mosquito in the air, lays eggs on the mosquito's abdomen and then lets the mosquito go. And so then the mosquito comes and lands on me, and when it's biting me, it drops off those eggs. It's like a UPS delivery truck without knowing what it's doing. And then it drinks, you know, a little bit of blood and leaves, just like a mosquito does, but that egg stays behind, and then it hatches into a maggot. And then the maggot crawls down into the hole that the mosquito drank my blood through, and then it sets up shop. And this maggot has these little bristles on it so that it won't come popping back out if I squeeze it like a zit. And it starts growing. And if you leave this thing until it, you know, so it can have its way with you, it'll stay in your flesh for about 6 weeks, and it'll grow to be an inch long maggot eating your flesh. And I knew what I had coming down the pipeline, so I was bailing on that right away. My friends would look at it, and sometimes they could see the little white tube coming out when this thing took a breath. I mean, it's just like, you couldn't make this stuff up. Nature truly is more vulgar than anything you could ever put in a movie. And so anyway, I went to the hospital, and I had to convince this doctor that of what I had, because they thought that it was an ingrown hair, and I was having a polite argument with them about, no, this is not an ingrown hair. This is much more serious. You need to get this thing out of my head before it crawls out. So I only had it for a couple of weeks, maybe 2 weeks, and I had it surgically removed, and I keep it in a little jar at my desk. The doctor put it in a little urine sample container. It's clear. You can see through it. It's got a little orange lid, and that sits on the shelf right next to my desk. And to be honest, that was a real turning point for me, and that's where I start the book, is with this story, because you know, people say, do you ever feel like you're at one with nature? You can't be any more at one with nature than to have a parasite feeding on your flesh. I mean, that is what happens out there. That's what it's like to be an organism. And so I felt like that gave some authenticity to my claim that I knew anything about nature at all.
No, I should watch out for growing, moving mosquito bites, huh?
Yes. Watch very carefully. But you know, knowledge is power. So if you do start, if one of your mosquito bites does start growing, you'll know exactly what to worry about instead of just worrying, you know, about a million things. And it won't kill you. In fact, I've told a lot of people, if you're going to get a parasite, you definitely want to get a botfly, because it stays in one place. It doesn't spread to your liver. It doesn't come back year after year. The worst case scenario is you have a funny scar on your skin at the end of it. It hurts a little, but not even that much.
So tell us why you wanted to save your maggot.
Well, you know, when I finished, they took it out, and the doctor said, you know, well, sure, we're going to put this into the collection at the local university. And I said, there's just no way. I earned that thing. Like, I want that. And, you know, I'm a biologist, so I've got, you know, a couple of skulls at home and other crazy things like that. It's embarrassingly small. I got it removed so early that it just doesn't compare. If you go on the internet and start looking for bot flies, you can find some pictures that will really turn your stomach. And one of the things I do with my book is I try to make sure I make those links as available as possible. So, you know, as I'm doing the research for the book, which is all based on the scientific literature, I get, you know, all the details of how those maggots live and how long it's going to take them to survive. And then I put some links in there so people can find the really gross pictures. But when people come to my office, because they've, you know, some of the people I work with have read my book, and they'll come by and they'll say, okay, I want to see it if it's by your desk. And I'll show it to them, and they'll say, oh, that's it? It's just so little. And I'm like, but it's a bot fly. Like, if I left it, it would have been an inch long. So anyway, it's a good time, but it really, for me, it's part of the fun of nature, is that it does have this dark side, and that's what makes it so attractive, is that it's a little bit dangerous, it's a little bit scary.
You outline in the book a list of about, I guess, the seven sins in the world, or the seven evils in the world. Why did you organize it this way?
Well, so once I just sort of figured out that I was going to tell the dark side of nature, it was just like an overwhelming avalanche, because, you know, I'd been a biologist for more than 10 years, so I had all these scientific papers that I knew about. And then as I started following up on the leads, you know, I started coming to new papers that were saying even more disgusting things that I didn't know about. And I was feeling overwhelmed. And so I was sitting on the couch talking to my wife, who's also an evolutionary biologist, thankfully. And I was telling her about the fact that I was stuck with this, and I didn't know how I was going to organize it. And she just said, seven deadly sins. And it was immediately clear it would be a fun challenge to go through the seven deadly sins, you know, wrath, lust, sloth, greed, and go through them trying to see whether nature, in fact, does a better job of of those sins than we do. And it does. I mean, nature is, it's, you know, lust. You know, humans can make all the noise they want to about lust, and we can feel like we're lusty and all these things. But when animals are lusty, they take it to a new level. There is a spider called Nephelengus, and this spider really wants to mate with a female. But the problem he has is that the female is much bigger than him, and she will try to eat him. So what he does is he approaches very, very carefully, and he, you know, if he's lucky enough not to get eaten on the way in, which is a risk, he gets close enough, then he starts mating with her, and he actually has two penises, which are on the sides of his head, and once he puts those where they need to go, he rips his genitals off of his body and runs for it, so that he leaves them in the background doing their thing as he tries to escape this female who will eat him. And three quarters of the time, she catches him, and she eats him, but then she's distracted by a meal while he is mating with her in the background, right? And so it actually is an effective strategy. And if he does escape her, what he will do is he'll set up shop just outside of her reach, and he will attack any males who come anywhere near her, because he's made his investment. He's not going to grow those things back. So he really wants to make sure that his mating is the one that fertilizes as many of her eggs as possible. And so he will fight off any other males. And so, you know, I don't know many humans who would be willing to do that for lust. And,
no.
And so it's taking it to that next level that really makes nature so incredible, is that it's stuff that you couldn't make up.
Doing anything for love, I guess. Why did these spiders and many spiders evolve this way? Why do so many female spiders eat their mates?
That's a good question. You know, it's funny because we're used to thinking from a human perspective, and humans, for the most part, we're long lived, and it takes us a good long time to get our kids out of the house, right? I mean, 20 years or whatever before your kid is grown up and will move out of the house, and then you're still sending money. And it works really well for humans to have a team, to have a mom and a dad or two parents anyway, you know, taking care of the kids together, because it is a very hard, I was raised by a single mother, so I respect how hard it is for a single parent to do it. And it's easier if you have two parents helping. And so the way we see the world is sort of biased by that experience. But when you look out in nature, what you'll see is that a male just wants to pass on its DNA, and a female just wants to pass on her DNA. And what they're looking for in a mate is the best possible DNA to mix with their own. But that doesn't mean they're on a team with that other animal. It doesn't mean that they're going to be a partner. It just means that they're thinking about their own selfish interests. Sometimes their selfish interests will lead them to work together, but often that won't happen at all. And there's a great example of that in these weird little flatworms that live in the Great Barrier Reef. And these flatworms are hermaphrodites. So they have male parts and female parts. And when they meet another flatworm, and they're beautiful. They look like little flying carpets. They're brightly colored. They're just really great looking. But when they meet another member of their species, they get to mate. But one of them is going to be the male and one of them is going to be the female. Now, whoever's the male only has to pass on sperm and then leave. But whoever's the female has to grow eggs and raise these babies and put a lot more energy into it before the babies are going to hatch. And so there's a disadvantage to being a female and an advantage to being the male. So when the two of these things meet, they have a little fight to decide who's going to be the male, the winner, and who's going to be the female, the loser. And what's funny about this is that they each have two penises, and they actually have like a sword fight with them. It's called penis fencing, and that is the scientific term for what they do, which is what I love about science, is that scientists are absolutely in on the joke. They have the same sense of humor the rest of us do. And so they have this penis sword fight, each of them with two swords, and whoever manages to stab the other one will inject sperm into them and then swim away, and that becomes the dad. And whoever got stabbed and lost has to be the mom, and that's the way it works. And so, you know, this with the spiders, it's the female is just trying to survive, and she knows she's going to be able to find a male no problem, and if she eats this guy, tough for him. That's not really her problem. She's still going to be able to find sperm. And for the male, if he wants to pass on his DNA, he's got no choice but to dance with the devil. He has to go in there and make his attempt, because if he doesn't, he'll never pass on his DNA, and he won't be in the next generation.
And hey, a gal's got to eat, you know?
Yeah, the girl's got to eat. Absolutely, absolutely. And that's part of her strategy, is to sit there and let the males do their bidding.
We are talking with Dan Riskin. He is an evolutionary biologist. He is the author of Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, a lively tour through the dark side of the natural world. And we are exploring the dark side of the natural world. And we're welcoming your questions, maybe your examples of some of that dark side. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Dan Riskin, an evolutionary biologist, host of Animal Planet's Monsters Inside Me, and author of the kind of creepy but fascinating book, Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, a lively tour through the dark side of the natural world. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming any examples you might have about the dark side of the natural world. Have you ever wondered if there's an evolutionary purpose for, you know, a strange animal behavior that you might have witnessed in nature? And why do bed bugs even exist? I'll ask that in a bit. But we also welcome your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lots of callers. Rick in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Joy. This is Rick. I appreciate so much the show today, and I appreciate your having this guest on. I'm enjoying it immensely. I'm a alum of UW Stevens Point, as I know you are, Joy. When I was in college, I remember the dean of the College of Natural Resources, Dan Treanor, told a story about having traveled to the Arctic region. I think it was in the Canadian province of in the Yukon Territory, and he was sitting around the campfire with the Inuit people, who were literally popping those bots. They were literally eating them, and it was considered to be rude and impolite if you weren't to do that. So he didn't have much of a choice, and he literally was eating those bots that you had described previously. They would harvest them off of the hides of the caribou that they were eating, and I think that demonstrates how much we are in harmony. Those people who live in the natural environment have to be quite creative and look for a good source of protein such as that, and we are secluded or separated from it because that's so disgusting. But again, thank you for your guest today.
Yeah, Rick, thanks a lot. Somehow I was relieved when you said they were harvested off the dead caribou rather than, I thought maybe they were harvested off the Inuit and then eaten. But so it would be rude not have you ever eaten a botfly larva, Dan?
Wow, that is the best thing I've ever heard. I had no idea that happened, and that takes it to a new level. Eating botflies out of a caribou. That's awesome. I mean, that's the thing is, I mean, the botfly that gets into humans is just one kind. Actually, I think there are a couple. I think there's the one that I got in Belize, and I believe there are some other ones in Africa. But botflies as a group are quite a successful group. A lot of wild animals get other botflies. I mean, horses in North America certainly get botflies, and cattle can get them too, I believe. And I'm not surprised that caribou get them. I didn't know that people eat those botflies. But what it sort of drives home is that if you made a list of every kind of animal in the whole world, caribou, botfly, giraffe, whale, more than half of your list would be parasites. And so when you sort of think about what the natural world is like, if you go to a zoo or if you even go to a museum, you see all the big animals, but you don't think about the fact that their guts are filled with worms and their lungs have parasites in them and their flesh might have botflies in it and that their fur has mites and ticks in it or their feathers have mites. And, you know, there are specialized leeches that live inside the nostrils of birds that only live there and don't live anywhere else. And it's just, there's a whole other world there. And the fact that the people that that Dan Traynor was interacting with were sort of more in touch with that, I think also speaks to the fact that we live in this society where we've done a really good job of putting all that away so we don't have to look at it. I mean, the fact that we don't have as many parasites as humans have had historically or as humans have in other parts of the world today is a big part of our experience and part of the reason that we live as long as we do.
Thanks, Rick, very much for the call. Cynthia in Menominee is with us now. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I told your screener that I have a rat that eats, a snake that eats only live rats. And my husband gets grossed out when I get so excited because my snake is eating. I think we are too far removed from nature. I love the little creepy crawly things on the ground and just see how they maneuver and how they succeed. Sawbellies, the little bugs, turning over a rock, that would freak people out. But wow, what adaption.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you. Yeah, you're absolutely, I love watching animals feed as well. And you feel sorry for the little one, you know, for the little mouse or rat that's getting eaten. But watching a predator do its thing is really incredible. And what a predator can accomplish is just, I mean, to be able to subdue an animal. I mean, what a snake does is it subdues an animal even though it has no arms or legs. I mean, that is just incredible. It requires incredible biomechanics of its body if it's going to pin it. And if it's a venomous snake, then the chemistry that goes into subduing the animal is just as interesting. I think there's a whole world there, and I really do get into that in the book, too. I'm completely on the same page as you. There's a beauty there, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you very much, Cynthia, for the call. Well, I did want to talk about the bed bug. That's another one that I believe is in the lust category because of its interesting way of procreating. But can you just tell us why some of these creatures even exist?
Well, you know, that's evolution for you. It's a bummer, but there are all these creatures and they're just trying to survive. And if their strategy works, they get to keep going. I mean, and mosquitoes don't make life any better for us. And mosquitoes transmit all kinds of diseases, including malaria, that kill literally millions of people every year. But the mosquitoes are winning. They're doing their thing. And despite all our efforts, spraying and otherwise, we can't seem to keep up with them. And that's the law of nature, is that if an animal can pull it off, they get to keep going. And bed bugs are fascinating. There are all kinds of different bed bugs. They feed mostly on the bed bugs are a family of bugs, and they feed mostly on animals, but there is that one kind that feeds on humans. And if you look at the evolutionary relationships of that bed bug to its relatives, it looks like it came from a bat feeding bed bug. So it looks like when we were living in caves way back in the day, some of the bed bugs that were feeding on bats started feeding on humans, and then those became more and more adapted. And we still have those bed bugs around today that feed on humans. And people get grossed out by the fact that bed bugs drink our blood, and I think that's fair. But what bed bugs do when they mate is 20 times worse than the fact that they drink blood. The mating in bed bugs is absolutely one of the most repulsive things that I know about in biology. And here's why. A female bed bug, let's say you go to a nice hotel, you set up shop, you go to sleep, the bed bug crawls out of the light socket, makes its way across the floor, crawls up the bed. It's using the carbon dioxide and the heat to find you. It finds a place on your skin. It bites you. It drinks a little blood. It maybe bites again, drinks a little more blood. And this is all that bed bugs eat is blood. And then it makes its way back. This is a female. She makes her way back down across the floor, and she's headed back for her hiding place. And this is the moment in time when she is at her most fertile. And the males know it. And they can use their acute sense of smell to figure out exactly what's going on. And so a male wants to mate with her, because if he can mate with her now, he will have a good chance of passing on his DNA. She, on the other hand, doesn't really need to mate with very many males. She would get enough sperm from one mating to last her whole life. But males don't care. Their goal is not to make sure she has babies. Their goal is to make sure she has their babies. Mm-hmm. So a male will approach the female, and she has a hole through which she lays eggs, but that's not what he goes for. He has a knife-like penis that he uses to stab her in the gut. And he stabs a hole into her and then injects his sperm right into her body and then lets her body deal with the aftermath. So he does that, And then he leaves after that. And this experience, it's called traumatic insemination. This experience lowers her life expectancy significantly. And that's how she gets the sperm. And then she has these internal organs that will clean up the mess. She has to have her immune system. It's a dirty sword. So she has bacteria and fungi that have been introduced that her immune system has to deal with. And then she can move the sperm down to where the eggs are. But that's not the end of her walk across the floor, because right after that happens, another male will do the same thing to her, and then another male, and then another male. And the average is about 5 different males will do this to her as she makes her way across the floor, every time lowering her life expectancy. And she can't stop them. She can't run away from them. They're too fast. They do their thing. And the problem is that if you're a male and you know that she's already been through this 4 times tonight, if you are the 5th, whichever male is last will have the 68% of the babies will be his. So all the males have an incentive to attack her, even if she's already had a very hard time getting across the floor. And so this is what happens to bed bugs every time they mate. This is how they mate. And it's just a reminder that what happens in the natural world is not in any way indicative of how humans should be conducting their lives. I mean, people use, you know, people say, oh, it's natural for this, so that's why we should do it. And natural is used as a justification for things, you know, and especially with marriage equality, people love to talk about the fact that, well, it takes a man and a woman to make a baby, or they'll argue it's natural for homosexuals to exist because we see it happening in bats and rabbits and all these other animals in nature, penguins. And the truth is, you can't say if something happens in nature that it's okay to do. And bed bugs are a perfect example of this. There's no way that bed bug system is at all okay for humans. And to say that it's in nature and that's why it's okay for us is completely backwards. And so, you know, it makes you feel bad for the female bed bug, if anything. And it's a good reminder that nature, it really is a dark place sometimes.
Yeah, and I mean, this does not sound like a good deal at all from an evolutionary standpoint for this poor female bed bug. What in the world, you know?
Not at all. I mean, and she's really, biologists love to study this system. They use terms like runaway sexual selection, the truth is that she's found herself in a position where she really just doesn't have the upper hand, and so males really hold the upper hand in that situation. There are lots of animals, on the other hand, where females have the upper hand and males are stuck. And so, for example, there's a frog called a Tungara frog that lives in Panama, and females will only mate with those males if they will call out loudly into the night. And so a male, if he wants to mate with a female, has to sit in a pond and shout as loud as he can. And the number one animal attracted to that is an animal called a frog-eating bat. And so, I mean, if you can imagine, you're just saying, eat me, eat me, eat me. And that's the only way you can meet a female. And so males get picked off like it's their job. They get eaten all the time. And yet females will not give them a break. And so, you know, sometimes females get the upper hand. Sometimes males get the upper hand. But in general, you start to see, you know, sex and creatures as more, you know, that the animals, even though they're mating with each other, can fundamentally almost be in competition against one another.
Jan emails, cool show. Aren't words like icky, vulgar, rude, etc., words that are based on our human judgment? Is there really a good or bad in nature? Aren't we the ones who make the judgments on what goes on in the natural world? And let's not forget, humans are a part of nature, too. So,
great points. And really things that I had to think about a lot when I was writing this book. I mean, I do use the 7 deadly sins as sort of the backbone of my book, but of course, sins are completely human ideas. You know, there are two ways to think about that. And it's a really great point. One thing is that, you know, yes, these are just words we made up, icky, gross, you know, that's just up to our decision. But we evolved with innate preferences that help us survive. And one of the innate things about us is that some things look disgusting to us for a reason. There's a reason that when you see a dog poop on the ground, you don't want to eat it. That would be a great way to get sick. And if you found poop in, you know, on a burger, you would probably not eat that burger. And that's because you instinctively are repulsed by that, because your DNA has programmed you to avoid those kinds of situations that would get you sick. And when you look at human evolution, you know, predators are scary. Bears, tigers, lions, those are all things to worry about. But in, you know, if you look at what people really died from, it's things like the plague. It's things like amoebic dysentery. It's things like malaria. It's the little things you can't even see that do the most damage. And so having these innate, you know, the fact that something looks disgusting to us isn't totally arbitrary. It actually has an evolutionary basis. And it's really interesting to think about the world that way. There's a reason that we get scared when we see a big bear come around the corner. And there's a reason that we get disgusted when we see dog poop on our sandwich. I hope nobody ever sees that. But if you did, you can imagine hypothetically that that would be your reaction.
Oh, boy, we're not going to get to all of the seven sins and more, but we have so many callers. Let's go to Fred in Palmyra. Hello, Fred.
Hey, good morning. This has been a lot of fun to listen to. A couple of my buddies and I were talking about one thing or another, and the subject turned to squirrels. And one of my buddies insisted that gray squirrels will do some really obscene things to red squirrels in the area to rid their area of the red squirrels. Can the guests comment on that?
I don't know much about squirrel interaction specifically, but I can say that that sounds right. I know that gray squirrels do outcompete red squirrels where they're in the same area, and their gray squirrels have been spreading their range at the cost of the red squirrels. But, you know, what that speaks to is, you know, people talk about nature, they talk about this natural balance. And there's this idea that a lot of people have that there's one way that nature's supposed to be, and that when you leave it alone, it settles into this nice order, and that the animals know what that order is supposed to be, and they will do what they're supposed to do to maintain that order. And your friend's experience with the squirrels really speaks to the truth of the matter, which is that animals really only want to pass on their DNA and have as many babies as they can. And that's the game. And when you see nature in this nice balanced harmony, what you're seeing is a stalemate where every animal is being held back from doing more, having more babies by some other aspect of nature. And it's like a house of cards. And what will happen is if you introduce a new animal, like a gray squirrel, it might change the natural order. And so they might outcompete those red squirrels, and they might do horrible, violent things to them, like kill them or attack them or steal their food, or worse, things I wouldn't even try to guess on the radio. But believe me, I've heard of animals doing really terrible things to each other. Those things can happen, and then what ends up happening is that the house of cards rebuilds, but it's different from the way it was before, because there isn't this innate one solution to the way things are supposed to be, and nature is always changing, and it's a dynamic place, and the animals don't have an innate sense of how things are supposed to be.
We are talking with the author of Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, a lively tour through the dark side of the natural world. Dan Riskin is a evolutionary biologist and host of the Animal Planet's Monsters Inside Me. And we are talking about the dark side of nature. Nature is actually full of threats to our well-being, and we're talking about some of those threats and some of those behaviors and the evolutionary purpose to some of this. And we're welcoming your questions for him, and we're welcoming any stories you might have about the dark side of nature. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Dan Riskin, who is the author of Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, a lively tour through the dark side of the natural world, talking about some of the horrible habits that he has observed in plants and animals, acting out something that he compares to the seven deadly sins in the book. And we're welcoming any questions you might have at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, we didn't get to all the seven sins, and I'm not sure we're going to, but I'm interested in ways you see greed manifesting itself in the natural world.
Well, I mean, the greed, I think, is where it all starts. And when I talk about greed, I sort of draw a parallel to sort of, you know, when we think of greed, we think of money. That's the obvious thing. And Scrooge is the obvious character that comes to mind, who just cared more about money than anyone or anything else, and always was trying to optimize money. And then these ghosts came and told Scrooge that, you know, you're not going to get into heaven if you do that. And then he said, oh, well, then I won't optimize money. I'll optimize getting into heaven. And then he started being nice to everybody, which fundamentally, in my opinion, was still him being greedy, because he was still looking out for his own selfish interest. It was just when he realized that there was a way to be even more, he just changed his currency. Anyway, that's my opinion on Scrooge. But when it comes to animals, they really behave in a way that makes you think that they're trying to optimize passing on their own DNA and surviving and passing on DNA. And whatever behavior it is, that is just the answer that keeps coming up over and over and over. And so with that as sort of the guiding principle, you know, the book goes forward from there. And you know, one great example of that is these mice that live on an island out in the Atlantic called Gough Island. And so this is kind of a scary story, to be honest. This one freaks me out. There's this island where albatrosses and other seabirds lay their eggs. And it's out in the middle of nowhere. And these birds are out in the middle of nowhere feeding on fish. And this is where they go to lay their eggs. And so it's a small island. I think it's half the size of Lincoln, Nebraska, or something like that. And they lay their eggs on this island, and there are no trees, just on the ground, but there are no predators. And so this is a great system, and it's worked for thousands or perhaps millions of years, and everything's been fine. But then some people went and visited that island in about 1810. And when they did that, they dropped off some mice accidentally. And mice are fairly harmless for the most part, but every once in a while, mice will be, they will scavenge on dead meat if they find it. Usually they eat seeds and stuff like that. But every once in a while, rarely, a mouse will take a bite of meat. And what happened was these mice started feeding on the dead carcasses of seabirds, and they started flourishing. And then not just any mice flourished, but the mice that had a preference for meat started having more babies than the other mice. And pretty soon you had mice that were kind of specializing on these carcasses. And it didn't take long for the mice to figure out that they didn't have to wait for a baby seabird to be dead before they could start eating it. And so this is what happens today, is you can go to this island and set up a night vision camera, which researchers have done. You put it on a baby albatross and you watch, and it gets dark out, and the albatross is sitting there totally helpless. And then one mouse comes up and tries to take a bite of its eye. Oh. It's the scariest video you've ever seen, and I have a link to it in my book. And then after it does that, you know, the seabird kind of flinches, and then more mice show up, and more mice, and these mice just start chewing on the poor baby bird's body, burrowing their way into its body to eat its internal organs. And at one point, there's a hole in this thing big enough that you can see the internal organs of this bird, and it's just sitting there totally helpless. Its parents are out feeding, you know.
Oh, that's horrible.
It really is terrible. And what's happened is these mice they've changed. They're not normal mice anymore. It's only been 200 years, but already they've grown. They've got slightly different teeth. They're different animals. They're 2 to 3 times the size of a normal mouse now, and it's only been 200 years. And so it's been this little experiment of rapid evolution where they've become these predators, but they are decimating the populations of these seabirds. And so it's not going to be long before the seabirds disappear. And once they do, you're going to have a whole bunch of mice that only know how to eat meat that are going to be out of a food source. And so here they are on this island just decimating all their food, and they're not thinking ahead, because all they're trying to do is selfishly eat as much food as they can and have babies of their own and try to compete with the other mice that are on that island. And, you know, they were born there. This is the world they've known since they were born. They're just playing that game, and they're not at all thinking about the long-term solution. And the obvious analogy is, what are we doing with our planet, and why are we acting like mice? nice, right? Why do we have to be thinking short term? I just want to make sure my kids get into a good school. I just want to make sure that, you know, my state has good funding. I just want to make sure that my country is doing okay. You know, that short term selfishness that characterizes animals is part of our DNA too. It's our instinctive way to think. It's instinctive to care more about your kids than about a kid you don't know. And for the most part, that's fair and fine. But the mice are painting themselves into an evolutionary corner where they're going to live on an island that they can't survive on anymore. And we are making all kinds of decisions as a species that have very strong analogies to this. And this isn't really what the book is about, but it's one of the big take-home messages from it, that we are natural animals, we come from nature, but we don't need to limit ourselves to the things that animals do. We can take it a step further. We can be more intelligent. We can make smarter decisions because we're not stupid mice on Gough Island that have to eat themselves out of house and home.
And they probably will start eating each other.
Yeah, that'll happen. But the math is that once they start eating each other, the food's going to dwindle quickly, because you got to have some other food going into that chain. Otherwise, it just self-destructs.
Let's go to Kevin in Fort Atkinson. Hello, Kevin.
Well, that's thank you for taking my call, but that's a very good segue as to what my comment is. The sun's been shining on the earth, and at some point life started to take that energy and store it chemically in certain molecules. And since then, somebody else, instead of storing that energy, has wanted to eat that energy from the other person who's producing it, or the other individual. All the way up to a zebra who has hoofs to run, but the tiger or the lion has claws to hook it and teeth, spike teeth to bite it and harvest all the energy that has been gathered by that. So to me, I look at all these energy flows, and that's what it really is, just energy flows. Who can take advantage of a dead animal? There's a pile of energy there. There's a bunch of things that are going to glom onto it and try to extract that energy. And once they have it, somebody else is going to try to get it. And when they poop their poop, there's bacteria that eat that. It's all just an energy flow, a chemical energy flow. And the DNA is just a program to take advantage of any avenue they can to absorb it and use it.
Yeah, is that what we just want, energy, Dan?
Yeah, I love it. It's like you're reading my gluttony chapter to me. We're totally on the same page. That's exactly what happens. You know, we can't get energy from the sun, and the sun is where all the energy comes to the earth. And it's only through plants that we can get access to it. We either have to eat plants ourselves, or we have to eat the animals that eat the plants. Otherwise, we die. And that's true for all the animals. And what's really neat is that, and you're totally right, it is a big game about getting energy and then keeping it away from the animals that want to eat you. And the plants are playing exactly that game. And so a plant sets up shop, it has leaves that photosynthesize, it gets energy from the sun. And then for a plant, getting eaten by a deer is the worst thing that can happen to you, because you'll die, right? If it eats all of you, you're gone. And if it eats a leaf, you have to pay all the energy to grow a leaf back. It's really bad. And so in general, plants work really hard to stop animals from eating them. And yet we have this idea that nature is this vegetable garden that wants to make us healthy and wants to give us all this food. And so, you know, you go to the grocery store and you see this big wall of produce and you're like, oh, isn't nature nice? It's trying to feed me. But nature isn't. If you made a list of all the plants in the world, your list would have 250,000 species on it. And humans get 90% of our calories from 15 species. That is 1/160th of a percent of all the different plants that are out there. Most of those we can't even take a bite of. And if we did, we would either get absolutely nothing from it, or the plant would poison us.
Kill us.
To make us sick. It could kill us. So, you know, poison ivy, obviously nobody's going to eat poison ivy, but, you know, there are all these other plants that do much worse things. In fact, there's a plant that has to worry about sheep eating it, and it's evolved a defense so that if a pregnant sheep eats this plant, it's called corn lily, then the baby that is born a few months later is going to be a cyclops with only one eye. It's just amazing what plants will do to defend themselves. And yet we've sort of told ourselves that nature's trying to make us healthy, but you're absolutely right. That is, and it was a really fun chapter to write, because there are so many really cool examples of plants defending themselves or animals getting around those plant defenses. You know, and fundamentally, it's where we get all our food from, and it's how we interact with nature on a day-to-day basis. Every time you eat something, you're taking part in the big energy flow of nature. I love the way you put it.
You write about a bat's tongue and how that's an example of the way plants have evolved to be selfish. How so?
Yeah, well, so for plants, you know, feeding animals is usually bad, but every once in a while a plant needs something, and in return, it'll give an animal a little food. And so, you know, a bee feeding on a flower, the flower makes pollen, and it doesn't do that for no reason. It does that because when a bee comes and drinks it, it's going to accidentally get that, it's going to drink that nectar, and the pollen is going to get all over the bee's head. And when the bee travels to another flower, it's going to take the pollen, which is basically sperm, and drop it off of the next flower. And so really what the plant has done is it's used its nectar to turn bees into flying penises that can deliver their sperm where they want it to go. And so this is a great system, and bees are one kind of animal that do this, but this has happened in lots and lots of different kinds of creatures, and one of them is a bat. And of course, I love bats. That's what I did my PhD on. And there's this bat that lives in South America, and it has co-evolved with a plant. And the plant had is every time a bat visits the plant is trying to get as much of its pollen or sperm on the bat's head as possible, because that's going to increase the amount that goes over for the reproduction of the plant. So the plant's objective is to get as much on that bat's head as possible. So the plant keeps making the nectar harder and harder to reach. So the bat has to stick its head further down and further down. And this happened over millions of years. And what's happened is you have bats with really, really long snouts, but incredibly long tongues. And so if you hold your hand out in front of you and do a thumbs up symbol and imagine sticking your tongue out to touch your thumb, that would be one third of the length that this bat can do it. Wow. Its tongue is 1.5 body lengths long. And it's all because this plant has just been selfishly trying to get the bat to stick its head deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into this plant so that it can pass on its nectar. And so the plant has really just manipulated the animal's body just because it wants to have more sex. That's what it comes down to.
Well, Beverly on Facebook writes, I am loving listening to this with my two sons, ages 7 and 9. Is the book appropriate for kiddos?
It is. That's a good question. When I was writing the book, I imagined that I was my high school self and that this was the book that I wanted to discover. Because my experience getting into science was that I read a book about bats when I was in high school. And when I got to the chapter about reproduction, there was this great little part that talked about how big a male bat's genitals can be, and it just blew my mind. I mean, so the analogy was, if you can imagine a human standing, you know, holding two pumpkins in front of them, that's what the testes of a bat look like when it's ready to mate. And I was in high school, and I was like, are you kidding me? Can I read this? I felt like I was reading a dirty magazine in class. And what I've discovered is that science is just full of these things that really are, you feel like you're getting away with something. And so, yes, absolutely, the book is appropriate for high school and even middle school or junior high. But the truth is that it does cover some topics. You know, I talked about the bed bug earlier. There are some themes that are quite dark, but it is really only about animals. It doesn't get into any of the stuff that humans do. And so, you know, every kid's different, and they'll know when they're ready for it. But this is a book that if kids are listening and their parents aren't, convince them you're buying a science book, and then you'll get to read dirty things with your time. It's a great trick. And the truth is, I'm still getting away with that as a scientist now.
We have just a minute to go, Dan. This has really been fascinating. I wish we could get to more of the book. Leave us with one anecdote as to why it's important for us to know about the dark side of the natural world.
At the end of the day, I think that the dark side of the natural world is the best part of the natural world. I love these dirty things. And I think the fact that there's a snail that lives in the ocean that has a poison or a venom that is so powerful that it can kill you in 5 minutes. It can shoot a little harpoon, it can sting you, and you will be, they call it the cigarette snail, because if you get stung by this thing, you have enough time to have a cigarette. And you don't feel any pain because there are all these painkillers in it. And I just think that those kinds of hidden treasures in the world, they're scary, but they make me feel emotional. They're exciting to me. They get my heart up, and that's what I love about nature, and that's what I'm trying to share. And I think that's the most beautiful part. It's not all flowers and cuddly panda bears, which are lovely, by the way. It's also the tapeworms that live inside a panda bear's gut.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now to go look for some botfly larva. Dan Riskin is the author of Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and Christy Taylor for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.